Hello and welcome to No Direction Beyond, episode 7. We are your Starfinder news, reviews, interviews, and increasingly features podcast. I'm Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param.
I'm Alexander Agunis, the Everyman Gamer.
I'm James, and I write Code Switch.
And today is an interesting and almost forced episode. One I'm very happy to do, however. Traditionally, we try to avoid like doing big episode features on things that our members, especially those on the show, have directly participated in, except for if it's a Paizo first-party product, because we can't avoid it, because you all write like crazy. However, we cannot ignore a book that has been the number one seller for Starfinder since the launch of Starfinder and does not appear to be wanting to give up that crown whatsoever. So, in a little bit of a breach of tradition and fully admitting that we have a lot of bias on this episode, so we are here to talk about the Starfarer's Companion, a massive 236-page supplement for Starfinder that dropped the same day that Starfinder dropped, which was impressive, written by our very own Alexander Agunis and our very special guest, Matthew Morris.
Hi, everybody.
Hello. Welcome, Matt. This is your first time on the show. How are you doing?
It is. I'm doing great. Thanks, guys. Happy to be here.
Awesome, awesome. Now, Alex and Matt, let's start with Matt, because everybody hears Alex talk a lot. Can you please describe what the Starfarer's Companion is?
Well, it's a book with a lot of options for people who want to expand their Starfinder game. It's especially useful to people who want to bring their favorite elements from Pathfinder into the Starfinder universe, but in a way that keeps balance in mind and keeps the changes in the Starfinder system in mind, without sort of monkeying around with the Pathfinder Legacy section themselves.
Okay. I mean, that's a pretty good description of the book, because that's describes half of the content of this book. But only half. There's a lot of new material here. Alex, could you go into describing what the thought process was to get together and start making this book, especially aiming for a launch date of day one?
Yeah. Okay. So it was really, really tough. It's the most difficult project I've ever done third party wise. I would argue that my giant 300-page Pack Magic book was easier because it was all spread out. Matt and I really didn't have the resources to do this book until I'd say right around, Paizo gave pretty much all third-party publishers the opportunity to sign on and make third-party content for Starfinder at about the same time. I think it was April when we all got it. I don't quite remember, but we all, pretty much everyone was given the option at the same time, and Matt and I sort of just bolted. Originally Owen asked me to do this by myself. I was like, no, I can't. There's no way. And when we went and we were picking out what to do, Matt and I were kind of well, what exactly do we want to play in Starfinder that we've done in Pathfinder that we can't bring into the future? Because I don't know if you would agree, Matt, but when I sat down and I read Starfinder, I was like, this setting is really cool, but did every player race and every go under a mass extinction from Starfinder Pathfinder to Starfinder? Did every single class just get completely absorbed? That doesn't seem right to me. At least my thought process was that even in the modern day, we might not know as much about medieval jousting and, archery techniques and swordplay techniques as existed hundreds of years ago, but we know enough about them now that those arts aren't completely gone. And at least to me, and I believe Matt and Owen agreed also, it didn't make sense to have everything completely disappear, and we didn't know what Starfinder's timetable on releasing products was going to be like, so we took a shot at it, and it ended up being really, really popular. Does that sound pretty accurate?
Yeah, I would say the I think the idea too that we had about that it expands the game in a way that makes the universe feel bigger. You know, that there might be systems where there's not as many technomancers and there are wizards instead. I think makes it feel like a more vast, like, space game.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's just like a lot of it is a matter of just wanting to make sure that people could play what they liked in any setting. When I originally pitched the idea to Owen, the basic gist of my argument was, I was like, if there's more stuff that's familiar, I think you'll have a audience of people who are more likely to play this new game because there's something similar they can latch on to. There's that thing that can be like, oh, I really like this. I know this. I'm going to hold on tight to this. And then eventually they'll spend out and go to other places. Like, in my experience, there aren't many people like James, where James is willing to just take a role-playing game and be like, well, here it is. I'm good. This is brand new. I don't need to know anything. Like, most people are not courageous like him.
Oh, you flatter me.
Oh, I try.
The other thing that I would say was, like, exciting about it and that we had in mind, especially when we're doing the things for classes, was, like, applying some of the modern class design sensibilities to some of the more traditional classes to make them more, you know, line up more philosophy-wise with Starfinder classes, you know, give them interesting things every level and, like, a lot of meaningful choices. I know that, you know, that's one of Alex's big things, especially where, like, the bard is concerned historically.
yeah.
And it was definitely, cleric. Or the cleric. And it was definitely a big thing that I was thinking about when I was doing the wizard as well.
I think a lot of people, when they read that we were doing this, they were like, oh, it's going to be just like Pathfinder Wizard, but for Starfinder. And it's like, no, like, Matt and I went through and we wanted to make sure that the classes felt like modern in the sense that the Pathfinder's cleric and wizard are certainly polished from 3.5, but between having dead levels, being mostly reliant on spells, and being a little crazy powerful at magic, probably the highest in the game because of it, we wanted to make sure that modern sensibilities in game design applied to those classes. And I think what we came up with was something that feels classic, but also is very, in fact, modern. Like, it feels like almost like an Unchained class, but balanced for Starfinder.
Yeah, looking over a bunch of the classes, that's how I felt. And initially I was kind of skeptical because I don't care about wizards. I'm fine with technomancers.
Yeah.
But looking through, not having dead levels really makes me think differently about those classes.
Yeah.
The one thing
I feel I was just going to say one of the things that I think we're trying for in the basic class design, especially for cleric and wizard, was having, based on the class choices you make, having them feel different regardless of what your spell choice is. Because there's always going to be spells that people are like, yeah, that's the best spell of that level. And it can make the classes feel very samey. So I think we wanted to definitely make different choices that made your wizard who focused on one thing feel very different from wizards that focused on a different school or schools.
Yeah, like one thing I did when I designed the cleric, Matt and I split the classes in half. I took bard, cleric, and ranger. Matt had paladin, magus, and wizard. And when I sat down to do the cleric was the first one I did because I knew it was going to be the longest and the most difficult. When I sat down, the first thing I knew immediately was that I wanted to make sure that variant channeling was the core assumption for the class from Ultimate Magic. So it's not like word for word take of that concept, but it is very similar. Like, you're like, oh, well, I can only heal fire creatures, and when I harm, everybody around me takes fire damage. Because that feels like something a fire cleric would want and be super into. Instead of like, I'm a fire cleric of Asmodeus, negative energy. It's like, I mean, that just kind of sells the idea that negative energy is bad, and that's not really true even in Pathfinder. So I felt like it was really important to give those sort of like flavorful abilities to the cleric, and the wizard kind of evolved in a similar direction.
I think that really was the point in which I kind of upgraded my opinion of this book, because I already expected it to be good. But when I was first reading through, well, it wasn't the first revelation I had, but specifically the reading through the classes part of it, it would have been very easy to produce this book where you literally just copy and paste the OGL Pathfinder section for these classes and then go in and monkey the rule changes from Starfinder over and sort of cudgel them in with a hammer. I mean, this is a preschool toy and you're just like slamming the peg into the wrong hole. That would have been very easy, and I don't think anybody would have blamed you, especially given the launch date. A lot of publishers had produced that sort of material. But I read through the Bard, and I was like, well, that was pretty good. And I started reading through the Cleric, and I was like, wait, no, this is a fundamental reinterpretation of this class that is from a design perspective of Starfinder that shows that the people doing this fundamentally know this system and know what makes it special and its strengths and aren't just trying to port the 20-year-old D20 system versions of these classes just a little bit further.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that you said that about our work. I think that that was sort of the thing that Matt and I most like struggled with, making sure that we had it. And I know that one thing that a lot of people are say, they're like, oh man, you know, you did this for Rogue Genius Games, you had Owen. Like, really, when you get down to it, Owen made suggestions and Matt and I implemented them. Everything was written by us. Mm-hmm. So, like, and it was not easy. The turnaround we had to work was very slow. It wasn't slow, I'm sorry. It was very long. It felt like it took forever. It moved slow, but the days went by quickly. I don't know if that's how you felt.
Well, I felt like that there was a time when all I could see in front of my face was like spells being converted in my dreams. The spells chapter had to be done in a very quick turnaround, let's say.
That is a bulky chapter.
Yeah. So yeah. Matt and I each designed about half of most of the chapters. Like, I took half the classes, he took half the classes. I took half the feats, he took half the feats. But then, like, there were some places where, in order to keep the word count as even as possible, where we were like, all right, well, you just do all of those, and I'll just do all of those. And what ended up happening is that Matt wrote every single spell in that book. Every single one of them he wrote. And I wrote...
That was a lot.
I wrote every single word for every single race in that book.
Yeah.
I also did all of the archetype conversion rules, and working with Matt Benanche, who is actually in chat right now, I got the framework done for the Blood Space campaign setting, which is sort of like a solar system that we're working on with Rogue Genius Games for sort of like a setting. Because while we were doing this, Matt Benanche was also doing a day one release adventure called Blood Space and Moon Dust. So he was like, all right, well, I got to incorporate as much stuff from this book as I possibly can. So while Matt Benanche didn't actually write anything in the Starfarer's Companion, he was sort of crucial into providing the context that the actual races appeared in. Because we wanted to make sure that when we presented races, we weren't just like, here's a cat, folk. Enjoy the cat. And like, we wanted to make sure there was some context and like world building that, you know, granted, if you just want to put them in packed worlds, I feel like it's really easy. Like, all of those races are in Galarian, so they all just live on Absalom Station or have spread out from there since. Like, that's easy. We can't just write that because that's first party content. So we kind of had to put the whole baseline of this setting that we're working on into the book. So
say have to, but I was shocked when I opened up to the first chapter and it was talking about this blood space setting. And then I was extra shocked when it wasn't just obvious generic space setting and it starts talking about empires and supernova disasters.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this did not need to be in the book. And I don't mean that as a criticism. It actually did enhance the book the whole way through. It definitely in the races section, but even in the class section, it helped that you guys had a baseline setting you were thinking of. And a setting that is very distinct from Pact Worlds. It definitely has its own almost darker flavor for it.
I don't know what you think, Matt, but like I always joked that it was like the 1980s version of interstellar space travel. Like
it definitely has inflections of that for sure.
Very heavy metal.
Even when we make Jacob draw all of the art for it, we're like, look, just go for like all of those like zaps and like, you know, just go for all of that 1980s retro space. Like that's what we wanted. I feel like having that design aesthetic in mind, like I mentioned, Matt had a lot of the major overarching plot details, and then I just made up stuff for the setting to suit each of the races that we did. So, like, Matt was like, oh, we have this gas giant. I was like, oh, gas giants have lots of planets, lots of moons around them. I know. Let's stick the cat folk on this one, and this is what happened. I like that race a lot because it has a bit of a joke in it in that... according to the fluff for the race, the catfolk have like this very distinct look to them, and then blood space happens and they all mutate, and so like in my brain I was like, okay, so like now if the players want to play like any of the three art types that we have in Pathfinder, in Starfinder, the actual race here says that that's okay, and then even offers even weirder ones, like I am a cat girl, but like one of my legs is a cat leg for some reason. It's supposed to be like this really like freaky thing, like because when you do outer space, you do it weird, and I feel like I needed to make sure that a lot of the races felt like they had either futuristic progression to them or just weird stuff to make it clear that like you could use this in Pathfinder, but like the default assumption is that it's a little bit different.
And I noticed that there's also two races that aren't Pathfinder conversions.
Yeah, there's the Deoxians and the Mechanoi, and they were really fun to make. They were both vaguely things that Owen was like, in Blood Space, I want to kind of see something like this, and I was like, okay. He wanted a Vulcan analog, like from Star Trek, and I was like, well, I could do Vulcans, but then everybody's going to call me out on it, and they're basically lawful neutral space elves, so I kind of don't want to do that. So what ended up happening was, this was like, okay, well, the Vulcans are all about, like, you know, sort of like this perfect logical mind. I was like, what if you take that and you apply it to a race that's all about bodies? And this idea of, like, this weird gene-splicing race that just wants to run around and steal your genes and, like, morph their bodies came out. And it also ended up being kind of like a race designed around build a race, which I thought was kind of cool. I mean, I'm weird. That's the kind of thing that I would like, because it's just like, whoa, wait, you're telling me I can grab this and then that, and I can mix them together, and somehow this is a race?
Now, before we go too far down the rabbit hole on the races, let's at least like sum it up for listeners that might not have ever heard of this book. It's kind of hard to think about that somebody hasn't heard of between the average
well, actually, campaign. I would like to hear what you guys would sum up the book as, but without me and Matt. I think that'd be really interesting.
Well, I want to go over the spine of the book first, and then
you can do that.
My super opinions. The races, I just kind of want to go over the content real quick. The classes that you guys included were, and I think that was sort of like the main big banner at first that kind of attracted attention to the book, was the Bard, Cleric, Magus, Paladin, Ranger, and Wizard, which are basically the classes that don't have obvious analogs into Starfinder's core classes. And the races, oh my good God, there's a lot of them. Azamar, Catfolk, Deoxians, Dampir, Gripply, Ifrit, Kitsune, Kobolds, Mekani, Mekani? I can never pronounce that.
Macaroni.
Mekanoi.
The Nagaji, the Oreads, the Samsarans, the Suli, the Sylphs, the Tengu, the Tieflings, the Undine, the Vanaras, the Vishkanya, and the Wayangs. Why? I mean, they're all done well, but... why did that particular race selection come about? Why is it so huge?
Well, the first thing I did is I took every single race in the advanced race guide that wasn't an obvious monster race, with one exception. I thought having an exception was important. My exception was kobold. And I was like, okay, well, let's do as many of these as I can. And when we had the base setting... like some of them just sort of clicked. Like, one of the big things in the setting is that it was a binary star system, which means you have two stars that orbit each other, and the entire solar system orbits around them. And one of the stars randomly goes supernova unexpectedly. But these two stars are only about the size of a sun, of our sun. So the star that goes supernova is only like a black hole that's only like 5 miles wide. Because when a star goes supernova, it keeps the same mass, it just becomes denser. And so it is basically this little itty bitty black hole. And the idea was, well, we have this black hole, like that's kind of like the ultimate symbols of like darkness and entropy. That feels really Weiyang to me, because it kind of is super emo Weiyang. And so we were like, okay, well, we have these planetoid ships full of Weiyang that just orbit around the edge of this supermassive black hole, and they just worship this shadowy black hole all the time because it's great. Like, they're super into it. And like, that's kind of what happened for a lot of the races, where we kind of just took them and like, can we put this somewhere in our setting? No. Well, then we're going to drop it. Yes? Okay, let's see where this goes. And if it felt cool, we kept it. And if it didn't feel cool, we sidelined it.
I think also the like whole space cantina feel that Starfinder is really, really going with, where, you know, they try to open up more and more races, and we saw that with Alien Archive, was definitely something that we had in mind too. The idea that there's just this vast variety of types of creatures that you can play, and that's a big part of the setting.
Yeah. And so like having a lot, like it, at least to us, to have the cantina feel going back on some of the classic legacy races kind of felt backwards to us, which is another reason why we tried to put as many of them as we could. And then some of them just felt like we could do really cool things with their racials. Like, originally I wasn't going to do Kitsune at all, believe it or not. The reason being that I told Owen that like I felt like the feel of the Kitsune worked better in like a fantasy, almost like setting like Galarian, especially in like Tian Sha, or a place where Tian Sha existed. And then the idea of making Magical Tail into a replacement class feature racial trait, where it just gave you the ability to swap out your class features for Magical Tail feats, happened. And it was kind of too cool. And Owen was like, well, you know, you have this fan base, Alex. It would be a shame if they didn't have your mark on it. And I was like, all right, let's do this. And we ended up getting the Iconic Ranger out of that, though. So I like that character. See, I don't regret making the Kitsune anymore.
This seems like a good time to remind everybody that we do No Direction Beyond live on Twitch every other Tuesday at 7:30 Eastern and 4:30 Pacific. I have to do that translation because it's slightly different than No Direction Prime. But most importantly, we have a live chat! A live chat that we encourage to ask questions to us and our guests throughout the episode, which we will then ask on air. So if you've got anything you want to know about this book or anything related to it, or just anything that we've done, go ahead and ask it in chat and we will get it on the screen.
Oh, we got a couple. CryptWalker76 says, Weiyangs creep me out. Yeah, we tried to play off of that with having them worship black holes. And then, let's see. Imperiosaur says, I do not believe Alex at all when he says he wasn't going to put Kitsune in there. That's fair. You don't have to believe me. It's true. But I understand where you're coming from. So, yeah, no, it really, Matt Benange says, oh, they really had to twist his arm. Like, it really, I just did it because I could. I mean, I will say, though, the art that goes with the Kitsune is from my Everyman Gaming line. One of the tricks that we did to get this out so quickly is that both Owen's company, Rogue Genius Games, and my company were investing resources in this book. So, you know, a lot of people are like, oh man, you know, it's all Owen, but like behind the scenes, like I was throwing money at this at the same time. Another trick that most other companies don't have, but because Owen and I are kind of partner companies, I don't know, it worked and it was an advantage in our court in that regard. But yeah, so I gave them my art for the Kitsune section, and then Owen was like, oh yeah, and then we're doing this Ranger too. I was like, well, there goes my plan of having one Kitsune picture. You're lucky that picture's awesome, and I love it. Mm. And then it got reused like twice in the book after that.
Now,
but yeah, go ahead.
Going back to the classes, I noticed that there was a bit of a fundamental change that you guys went with all the spellcasting. All the spellcasters are spontaneous spellcasters.
You want to talk about this, Matt?
I could talk about it a little bit, yeah.
Okay, well, you talk about as much as you want, and I'll chime in with anything you didn't say when you're done.
Sure. It sort of ties in with what we were talking about a more modern design sensibility. What I was really going for with the wizard spell design, at least, was the feeling of something more like an Arcanist, which feels like wizard spellcasting but updated to me, or did when I was looking for a solution for that for the book. And it also feels like a happy medium between Pathfinder and what we knew is in core Starfinder, where everything is a fully spontaneous spellcaster.
So from a design perspective, and this is another place where, like, Matt started with the wizard, I started with the cleric. We compared notes when we finished our first draft, and we were like, oh, I did that too. Yeah. Oh, I did that too. This is why I brought Matt on. He was great. But at least when you're talking about designing a prepared spellcaster, the problem with the wizard and the shaman and the druid and cleric is that and even the magus to a certain extent, is that every time a book comes out that includes new spells and for those classes, and let's face it, spells are a huge selling point of any book, those classes inherently get more powerful because they don't have any limitations on what spells they know or have available to. And while having the Arcanist spellcasting isn't a completely limiting option, because, you know, you can leave prepared slots open and research your book whenever you want, it does put a hard cap on the number of spells you have available at a time. And that inherently makes it easier to balance the class, because you can assume, like, you're going to have access to these many powers. And it makes it a little, at least in my opinion, because we can limit those spells that you have access to on a given day, we can then justify giving you better powers in the same way that the Arcanist has better class features than the wizard.
And not only just justifying better powers, but as far as, like, mental processing time to get your head around the character, if you're putting in more choices into the class, the idea that you're going to, like, have also this full spell loadout that you're going to change up every day, and have to make, like, very detailed decisions about every single day is just another, like, pull on your capacity to, like, grok the class all at one time with your powers and spells combined.
I mean, you can ask James. I get choice paralysis with spontaneous spellcasters. It's even worse with prepared spellcasters.
Spellcasting is the longest thing in a game.
It is.
Well,
yeah.
The reason I usually try to shoo new players away from the Arcanist, though, is that it's both. You get the complexities of both, because the spellbook can be infinitely long, or in this case, the magic iPad, which I giggled quite a bit seeing the magic iPad. That was great.
No, that's fine.
You still have to learn about the spontaneous spellcasting, which there really isn't all that much to learn. It's a much easier spellcasting to get your head around. But then you also have to slot in your prepared spells just like you were doing a wizard, except now you spam them, which is an added complexity. So I actually view the cleric and the wizard as being even more complex than their core counterparts.
Right. So I would actually argue that this is sort of counterintuitive, but because you're slotting in spells, and once you have those spells in play, they can't be changed, and you can cast them multiple times based on your spells per day. So the Pathfinder, Cleric, Wizard, etc. has this thing where, like, you have to try to decide, okay, well, I'm slotting in Fireball. Do I want one Fireball? Do I want two Fireballs? Like, you have to not only pick the exact, like, number, like, the exact spells you want, but the number of them that you want. And so by switching to the Arcanist mechanic, yes, while there's an additional mechanic that you have to understand between needing to know how to slot in spells and how to cast them, it takes out the choice paralysis option, which is how many. Because instead of being like, okay, well, I make this choice once and now I have Fireball all day, it's I only get one Fireball period. When is the optimal Fireball time? Yeah. The answer is every time is optimal Fireball time. But
why are you preparing other spells?
And the true...
I was just going to say, just to go off what Alex said, I feel like as Well, it was really important to me that we kept prepared spellcasting in some form for wizards, because I do feel like it's such an iconic part of the class. Especially when you're like a low-level wizard, it feels like a lot of the spellcasting is about regret, and that's not fun. You know, like either you regret that you picked the wrong spell, or you regret that you cast it at the wrong time, and now you would, like, this would be a much better time to cast that spell that you prepared once. So I feel like the Arcanist casting cuts down on that a little bit, too.
A good analogy for the wizard is that when you cast spells as a wizard, you're playing whack-a-mole, but different, each mole comes out of a hole that's a different shape, and all of your hammers have pegs for that shape, and you can only hit the hammer with the right peg shape in its corresponding hole. So you gotta hit the triangle hammer to the triangle hole, whereas with this, yeah, you're picking your spells, but they're all the same shape going in the same hole. Does that make sense?
That game doesn't sound fun.
No, it's horrible. No, don't play it. That's I mean, but like literally Param and I did an entire like rant on prepared versus spontaneous, which if you guys are interested in that, you should go listen to that one, because so we don't have to repeat it here.
Right. Well, there's also the concept that in Pathfinder with all its complexity that the wizard has any sort of limits on its number of spells per day is a myth. If you want to understand why, go listen to the special episode of Private Sanctuary we recorded called Param's Guide on How to Wizard Good.
Dude, Alex pulled one of those out at the table, and we looked at him like he was crazy.
Which one did I do?
Where you cast a spell from a lower-level spell from a higher-level spell slot.
Yeah, oh, it was great.
Yeah, we were like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, like we were fighting a monster, and the only way we could kill it was with negative levels. So we had a sorcerer. spam enervate, but like we're level 16, so we don't know how many enervates we're going to need. And our GM was like, "Well, you know, you only have 7 level 4 spell slots." I was like, "Yeah, but I have up to level 6. I'll just start burning through level 5s if I have to." And like James and my GM looked at me like I had just told her that like the Earth is actually flat and flat earthers are right. Like it was this bewilderment. Like, oh.
And it's not that the thing we're fighting could only be killed with negative levels. It's that was the only ranged attack we had.
Oh. Yes. Yeah.
I thought your GM was just being a particularly evil man that day, or woman.
No, she's a very fair woman, and we're just a bunch of idiots.
Oh. It wasn't that we were a bunch of idiots. It's that our bow ranger didn't show up.
She is not a person. She is an anti-aircraft platform that chooses to identify as a woman.
Oh wait. that thing was immune to piercing damage, though, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, guess what isn't piercing? Enervate.
that was the entire crux of the problem. yeah, that was fun though. But yeah, so
oh, it just comes to mind for me, Param, too. Another wrinkle with the prepared spellcasting with this that we had to sort of figure out was how it was going to work with multi-level spells from Starfinder. Mm-hmm. And the way we did it and the way we did prepared spellcasting with that sort of tamps back on the versatility that you get from the lower level spells, which is one of the problems with wizards when they get to high level. They have so many first level spells that, you know, that you can sort of have a low level option to deal with anything. And that multi-level spells, because of the way that essentially undercasting works in Starfinder, add to that problem. Since you, if you are a technomancer, only need to know the highest level one. If wizards work that same way, then they could have just this crazy array of utility spells prepared and still have versions of their best spells. Mm-hmm. So we tried to address that as well when we were putting together the prepared spell casting for the 9th level casters.
Yep, putting Matt on spells was a great idea. He is a much more experienced magic person than I am. I fight good.
Yeah, I do like magic people, so.
So that is deep.
So moving on from our 9-level spellcasters, because I guess they're the most different from what we see in Starfinder, so we got a lot to talk about there. But let's say that your bard, your magus, and a technomancer go into a bar, which of them walks out conscious?
the Magus.
Yeah. Whose side is the Bard on is the question.
Yeah. So I the Bard was actually something we got a surprising amount of pushback from Starfinder players. Not because the Bard is necessarily better than the Envoy, and I will say up and down that the Bard is on par with the Envoy, but the reason is that the Bard and the Envoy buff in different ways. The Envoy is a really great combination of both debuffing enemies and buffing allies, but the best way that an Envoy can buff an ally is by like giving them extra actions or giving them small bonuses to hit and damage and like flexibly choosing which buff to give out on a turn by turn basis, where the Bard is a very familiar buffer. It uses Inspire Courage as its primary mechanic, which is like, I'm singing and now you get +1 to hit and a bonus on damage based on my level, and it's easier to grok than the Envoy. I think the Envoy gets a lot of unfair hate because it's a very different class. Like, in terms of things that don't mesh up with Pathfinder equivalents well, Pathfinder does not have a class that can show that can mirror the Envoy well. It is a great class.
The closest thing to the Envoy I can think of is the old 3.0 Marshall class from the Miniatures Handbook.
Yeah, except the Envoy is way better than that.
Yeah.
It's just a class that you don't realize how good it is until it's just won you a fight. And, like, honestly, you're not going to want both a Bard and an Envoy in your group, but they both have their ups and downs. The Envoy can do their cool tricks pretty much every day, and the way it's designed, the Envoy has a wider array of skills than the Bard does and can hit higher bonuses sooner because expertise is a D6 roll, where the Bard is much more reliable in what skills it has, but is also a little more versatile because of things like versatile performance and the Bardic repertoire mechanic that I wrote for it. But they have magic at their disposal too, so it's like, what do you like better? Bard is actually designed to be more versatile than the Envoy, where the Envoy is stronger at buffing and debuffing.
I also think part of the pushback from that initially was that not everybody had fully adapted their expectations to what a different small bonuses make. In Starfinder, and how much tighter math-wise it is.
Yeah, I do have a question about that, because very often on like the Starfinder forums, you see people start throwing out suggestions, and they give Pathfinder math. How badly does that work with these Starfinder classes?
Oh, horribly. Horribly. That's a great question to ask, by the way. I think that if the easiest way, the simplest way to see how different the math systems are is to crack open Bestiary 1 and then crack open Alien Archive and lay out the monster creation table rules compared to the two of them. And what you'll see from Starfinder is that Starfinder's numbers are much more linear in terms of how they go up. And because of that, the bonuses are also tighter, like Matt had mentioned. Where Pathfinder has like a jillion bonus types that are all over the place and like things stack with each other, where Starfinder is much more restrictive on stacking. It took the community like about like what, a week or two before they realized that skill focus didn't stack with the class bonuses that you get from leveling up, and that skill focus was there to sort of just like ease the gap. So I think that the players are better now, like now that we're several months in compared to where they were in August. But I think, you know, for so long, a new D20 game coming out meant, oh, this is 3.5 math with just a different coat of paint on it. Where Starfinder is, as far as I know, the first D20 game in a long time to significantly change the math rules. Because I think that some of the games that are D20 based, that are modern, like people don't necessarily think of being D20 anymore because they're so far removed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the last time I started thinking about, I guess my closest comparison was reading and tweaking my head to learn Starfinder when I was learning it the first time was very similar to when I had to relearn D20 to learn Mutants and Masterminds. Now, Mutants and Masterminds isn't Starfinder, that's completely different math, but it was also another game that took the basics of D20 in the OGL and completely changed the underpinnings.
Yeah. Yeah.
The way that iterative attacks, you know, were removed in Starfinder really changes so much of the math that, you know, you get to that point in Pathfinder where your primary attack, you're going to hit almost always with your primary martial classes. And then your bonuses are affecting your chance for your iteratives to hit. Whereas you just don't really have that math in Starfinder because of the scaling of the weapon damage. You know, yeah. And the Pathfinder damage scaling is at least partially, you know, dependent on getting those bonuses to your iteratives, so your damage is hitting the expected level. Whereas you just don't have that in Starfinder.
Definitely, I agree with that.
Oh, we have a question from chat. It kind of pulls us back into class debate again. But
then I want to talk about the Magus.
Oh, yeah. Uh-oh. Let's talk about the Magus before we answer this question, because then it gets back to Cleric Wizardville. Sure. So let's talk about the Magus.
I like the change in the Magus. It's missing an ability, but it gains so much more.
Are you which ability are you talking about? Spell Combat?
Spell Strike.
Spell Strike.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Oh, man. All right, Matt, this is your baby. Go for it.
Sure. So, well, actually, of the three classes that I did, Magus was probably the easiest one to convert, since it already had the idea intrinsically of choosable class features that can make the class feel very different, which is a big Starfinder thing. So that helped a lot. I think the biggest problem was figuring out how it was going to work in combat without having iterative attacks and without like breaking Starfinder's action economy more than you would want to, and still have it feel like a Magus. So one of those changes was changing how Spell Strike works. And the other was making Spell Combat line up a little bit more with how the full attack action works in Starfinder, where you only get the two attacks ever.
So yeah.
Can you go over the changes you made?
Sure. Let me just... I'm trying to remember back... You know, everything that would change times. From this.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our audience doesn't realize that a book that comes out in August is written in 6 months before that and turned over months before it sees print. And we kind of go into that a little bit when we're interviewing PASO employees and they're talking about books that just came out that they finished writing a year ago.
Sure. So instead of probably the biggest... change, as James mentioned, is with Spell Strike. And that's instead of channeling your spell attacks through your weapon, you're getting a bonus based on your intelligence bonus to your damage. And so you can sort of Spell Strike all day, but it's more, the damage is more consistent and less bursty than your Pathfinder Magus.
Which is my problem with the Magus, so thank you.
Right. Yeah. Well, That was definitely something that we were very aware of. Where I feel like I'm pretty sure that you've had this experience too, Matt. I had this at a special where I GM'd at a Gen Con, where two brothers at my table were both playing crit fishing, spell striking Magi. So I just every encounter would be like, I spell strike it, I crit, here's 100 damage. I spell strike it, I crit it on my turn, it's here's 100 damage. I was like, well, man, there are just some roasted genies here. Enjoy these genie corpses.
And it's something that feels fun for a short period of time, but then first I feel guilty. It's like, you went out through all this work to like prep this.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's also something that would not work well with Starfinder because since spell damage doesn't scale, and your like higher level Magus combat is pretty much reliant on you being able to shock and grasp all day or frostbite, whatever your Magus spell of choice is. So that wouldn't have worked in that sense either. So we sort of had to come to a compromise about how you're going to boost your damage with Magus that's not dependent on that scaling first level spell damage.
And so, like, even another thing that got that Matt changed when he did it was the ability that lets you use your gives you full BAB while it's active.
Right.
I was going to say that, you know, the mathematic reason behind it is that, you know, Arcane Pool gave an enhancement bonus because that feels magic-y and cool, but there are no magic abilities in Starfinder like that go on weapons that improve your to hit. Like, that mechanic is gone. So if the intention was to give the Magus more attack bonus hits without giving them an extra attack, well, you know, extra attacks are now a class feature, so we could just choose not to give them that feature. I don't remember if that's what we went with or not.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, we I basically was trying to make it similar to the exocortex mechanic, or at least call to that a little bit and still feel like a magus. And we had to bring it in line in a few other ways there too, since really so much of magus is relying on swift actions, and those are really not a thing in Starfinder if it can be avoided. So I think some people who, when they first saw the magus, were like, well, why is this a move action now? But I think that was also just people not being as familiar yet with Starfinder, and so many of the things from Pathfinder that were swift actions are move actions now.
Yeah. Like, when you look at the magus by itself and compare it to the Pathfinder magus, a lot of the action economy changes don't make sense. But right. If you look at multiple changes throughout both our book and the Starfinder core rulebook and compare them to their Pathfinder versions, like, it's very consistent. Like, oh, this was a swift, now it's a move. This was a swift, now it's a move. The things that are swift actions in Starfinder tend to be, like, sort of honed in because they're not, it's not one free swift action around in Starfinder. And we had to try to like figure out like, okay, well, what do we want you to still be able to do when you use this ability?
Yeah. And the other thing that I think Magus highlights as well is how we tried to incorporate using your resolve points with the mm-hmm. Pathfinder classes that we were bringing over, and trying to avoid having separate pools of resources and use resolve as much as yeah. possible. We had to, for Magus in particular, I had to tinker with it quite a bit, so that you weren't killing yourself to enchant your weapon all the time, essentially, or you'd be able to come back from unconscious because you hadn't spent all of your resolve on enchanting your weapon. So that went through a couple iterations before we got to what showed up in the final book.
Mm-hmm. That's actually something that hits on like part of the Bard too, where like, since you're supposed to use resolve for things in Starfinder instead of like having resource mechanics, one of the things that had to change was how bardic performance works. Because in Pathfinder, bardic performance is like this round thing. And it's sort of a weird mechanic in Pathfinder because at low levels, you run out and you have to conserve from fight to fight. And you may only get to use a round or two. And like that's when like lingering performance is super useful. And like your charisma. But like where we're at right now in Reign of Winter, I'm a level 16 bard. I have almost 40 rounds per day, and since damage is so high now, the average fight only lasts maybe 3 or 4 rounds. So like you're talking about me going through, I need to go through like 5 or 6 encounters, and by the time we do that, everybody else is drained out of spells before that anyway. So one of the ideas for the bard is that performance lasts as long as you want it to, but you're limited. Benefit from it for these really powerful ones. And so if you want to use it more than once on a person, you gotta just keep pumping resolve into them. Yeah.
So go ahead, Jim.
I was gonna say, want to jump back to that question?
Yeah, that's what I'm gonna do. Matt Benanch asks, when balancing the cleric and wizard against the Starfinder classes, the mystic and technomancer, what's your approach there? So I think that's more pointed because all the other classes very clearly don't have an analog, whereas the cleric and wizard kind of do have a kind of analog.
Yeah, the magus.
Yeah, so biggest myth in Starfinder is that Technomancer is a wizard analog. It's not.
It's the bard.
It's magus. Much more like the magus with a robot bent. So do you want to start with this question or do you want me to start with it?
I have some thoughts.
You can go first.
I think the biggest thing is that there's a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction about the spell list itself. That for some people, having 9 levels of spellcasting is just something that should not be in Starfinder at all, and they feel very strongly about that. Obviously, Alex and I knew that, and we didn't want to just be like, that's fine. Let's add on 3 levels of spellcasting beyond what Starfinder already has. Which isn't what we did. We ended up dividing all of the existing spells in Starfinder based on what we thought their level would be in a 9-level system, and then balancing around that to make sure that, essentially a 6-level mystic spell is going to be a 8th or usually 9th level cleric spell. Or wizard spell, depending on sort of which part of the mystic you're dipping into. Since mystic is really the wizard cleric analog. When it comes down to it.
So, like, when it comes to 9th level spells, what basically happened was, like, we tried to keep the powerhouse spells that the Technomancer and the Mystic has, like your table-changing spells, I guess is a good way to put it, and we tried to make sure that like the Wizard and the Cleric got those at about the same numeric level. So I think in most cases they get them a level later, if I remember
right.
So like if a Mystic is going to learn Teleport at level 12, a Wizard gets it at like level 13 or 14 or something like that. So like... The general way that we balanced them was to simply make it so that like we weren't tacking levels on at the end. We actually made what Matt and I call a fake spell level at like level 3, and we did another one at level 6. So like all of the sorcerer, all the wizard spells at level 3 are actually not spells that a mystic and or a technomancer would even get normally. Like they're just a completely new set of spell slots that are wizard and sorcerer only, and we balance them to be in, it's like in the gray zone between second and third level, or in the other and between fifth and seventh and sixth level. And so we actually pushed everything back rather than we spaced it out rather than putting them all at the end, which was our big secret. And by doing that, we made sure that these classes did not get magic that was overpowered, and more importantly, the 9th level spell slots still serve as a capstone because that was the one level we added onto the end. But instead of making it a whole spell level stronger, they're like maybe half a spell level stronger, if that. And they tend to be spells that only the cleric and the wizard gets. So that's not true for all of them, but like some, most of them are like, yeah, this is your thing.
Yeah, and with Starfinder as well, what we wanted to make sure we did too was keep the like the big core tenets of the spellcasting philosophy, like of the spells themselves, in mind when we're doing the cleric and wizard spells. So, you know, there's no very little save or die spellcasting at all until very high level. You know, there are very few buffs and debuff spells at all. There's another that I was going to mention, and now it's slipping my mind. But
the damage is...
The damage does not scale.
So
that was a big change too, that it might be not obvious if you're just looking and seeing like, oh, there's 9 levels of spell casting here.
Yeah.
So why about the choice about scaling the spells themselves don't scale, but you added scaling damage to the class feature, like kind of like the weapon specialization, but more specifically with the wizard. You gave him like pistol Ray of Frost's.
Yeah, essentially, because the idea with that was if you really want to play that wizard that, you know, kind of doesn't want to get their hands dirty, that is not really a thing in Starfinder. As you guys said, like, Technomancer is more like Magus in that regard. So we wanted to have that so that that's the fallback. The damage scaling is always well below what you would have from a ranged weapon of that item level. So there's still that, like, you know, why would I buy items, you know? Well, you would do it if you want to do more damage, but if you want that to be your thing, you know, it can be your thing. It can be your contribution to the fight when you don't have anything else.
I could be wrong. Didn't you balance the Ray like somewhere in the ballpark of where improved unarmed strike is?
That is a good question.
I don't think it matches perfectly, but like improved unarmed strike sort of matches, like falls in that same like area where an unarmed strike, even with that feat, is never going to hit as much damage as like an actual weapon will. But if you find yourself hogtied in a prison security cell and all of your gear is stripped off of your body or whatever, man, oh man, you're going to be super happy that you have improved unarmed strike. Take care of all the security robots. It's kind of the same idea for the Ray. It's like, it's a good fallback, especially if you don't want to use your weapon on your money on a weapon. The cleric actually doesn't have that. I ran into this big problem with the cleric when I realized, I was like, oh yeah, deity's favorite weapon. That's a classic cleric thing. We got to keep that. OMG, none of these new gods have favored weapons because it's on a mechanic in Core Starfinder. Oh, man. Oh, geez, Rick. And then, so, like, it was kind of left really open-ended. Like, if your deity has a favored weapon, you get proficiency with it. And also, you get to do this damage. So, like, fear the person who's, like, a cleric of the Vesk god of conquest who has the Dashko. Like, clerics running around this wicked broadsword going, It's great.
Like Clerics of Gorum.
Clerics of Gorum. That's all you could ever want. Like that big war dude.
The other part of the wizard ray spell effect that's sort of baked in is what we needed to do to deal with the fact that Starfinder doesn't have touch spells, and Wizard still has one half BAB. So it's one of the few scaling bonuses that is in here, because essentially with, you know, you're not going to be able to hit with your spells because of the linear nature of the armor progression of the enemies that you're going to be facing, unless you have some kind of bonus as a wizard.
That's something nobody ever, like, asks us about, though, Matt. Like, no one's ever like, how come you gave the wizard 3/4 BAB when nothing else in the game has that? Even monsters don't have that because they don't build. I'm like, no. Like... we didn't want wizards with super good martial skills. That didn't feel right.
Well, and also it really does feel like one of those. I mean, one of the things we did when we were first starting after we had picked our classes was talk about what the like the most iconic class features were going to be that had to be included, like our non-negotiables. And half BIB for wizard feels very much like that way, and also differentiates it from anything else that's in Starfinder. So we really felt like that was one of those things that we didn't want to give up.
We didn't want to take away your noodle arm wizards.
Right.
your tacos.
Yes.
So I see you saved the familiars from single digit hit points.
Yes. Well, the
this is all you designed.
I did the familiar and companions chapter as well here, and there, I mean, really we had sort of a decent starting point to go from with the mechanics having some different kinds of drones, so there we really used that for a guide mechanically, and then I used the Pathfinder familiar system more as a guide thematically, you know, non-numbers wise, as far as what kind of abilities you were going to get from that. Excuse me. One of the other things that I did try to do was to even up the balance between having a familiar and getting extra action economy versus having an arcane bond as well. So one of the other, you know, additional class features that I did for Wizard was to make some mostly more thematic or utility uses for your arcane bond. So that was an attractive option for people who are like very set on the familiars are always better because that's a whole nother creature that you control and that breaks the action economy deal.
I am a huge fan of the companions because you gave them evolutions a la Eidolons.
Yeah. Which go ahead, James.
No, after you.
Well, I was just going to say that again, that sort of ties in with the idea of having like the more modern design aesthetic, and also feels more like felt more futuristic than what Pathfinder has, and also just gives you that idea of customizability. You know, one of the things like we had to think about a lot was like you can't be like you have a tiger because not every planet is going to have tigers. So we tried to set everything out with sort of some example creature types, some example body types, and guidelines that you could then customize with your evolutions to really get that, you know, the like weird out there space companion that you wanted, rather than something that felt like it just belonged on Galarian or belonged on Earth.
Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time giggling at the thought of a serpentine companion that has two melee weapon mounts and wielding a Dashoko. It's like on the ground and its arms are really long.
It kind of does a spin move like this. It's very dangerous.
It was the funniest thing I thought of until I saw the ranged weapon mount, and then I thought of duct taping laser pistols to the side of a snake. So it's really been a trip for me, and I've enjoyed that a lot.
I have to admit that the laser mount was just for shark companions at first, but then I just decided to give it to everybody.
I do like that there's no sweeping... this cannot have this, which right. I think is fun.
Well, you know, if you're... I was just going to say, if you're, you know, a lot of the idea behind these, especially if you have a mechanical companion versus biological, is that you're like modding it to be how you want. So, you know, you would think in this future world, you can make that work either through some kind of biological manipulation or, you know, like, you know, just riveting it right on the side.
The book does have an entire race that specializes in being genetically altered. Like, I feel like it's fair game at that point.
Yeah, I just think of those fish from Futurama where they have the walk suits, stuff like that, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Dush, dush. Or like Snowball and Rick and Morty.
Right, right. Why can't they have a mech suit?
I just want to duct tape a revolver to the side of my hexaferret.
That's Jewish. Fine. That's fair game.
Is that six ferrets combined, or is that one ferret with six sides?
Both.
Both.
Six ferrets with six sides.
You can play Starfinder on that grid of a creature.
Oh, man. Gosh. Is there anything else you guys want to know about?
Like, yeah, still well, since we just talked about the hex grid, can you guys go into... Okay, this book already had, like, everything, and then you guys added starships. Could you go into your, like, why starships and what did you add?
So, sure. I mentioned that we got the advanced third-party copy of the book, and we saw that they didn't really have a lot of pre-built starships. Like, there were some, there wasn't a lot, and so that was when I was like, hey, Matt, you're a couple thousand words under. I'm busy working on races. Do you want to go bash your head in a wall and do computers and these starships for me? And Matt, not knowing what he got into, was like, sure.
Right. Who would know that there were so many spreadsheets in my future? I feel like the thing about starships is it was a good place where we could make something that tied in with the flavor of the setting that we were going for. Because I did try to make each starship fit in with one of our factions that we had discussed and sort of have a place in the universe. But it's also something that is time consuming to make and like fiddly. And, you know, your party's going to like destroy it like pretty quick probably. So it felt good to have things that would be very helpful on the GM side as well. And sort of fill in some of the like gaps as far as, you know, you need like a tier 3 ship right now that does this, and you can just drop one of these in. So that I think was the motivation behind the starships. For the computers, I just really liked the computer system in Starfinder, and I thought it was one of the like cool, really new wrinkles of the system. When we were sort of testing stuff out together, I was like, man, I wish these. I love the computers. I want them to be like even more like granular and like how can we treat this like it's an encounter, you know, dealing with this computer and not like a, you know, because for some people I think, you know, you see a few computers and it sort of devolves into like just a series of computer checks, which there's so much like in the system at its core even. So like to make the computers feel more like a part of the adventure. So I you know, did some work on those to make them run sort of like traps are treated in the system, and to give some more options to give them sort of a more cinematic or more like narrative feel and give some suggestions about like how you might reward XP for that. And again, just sort of give you a few drop-ins. You know, there's a bunch of pre-made computers of different CRs, but
you're
also
so good.
But thank you. Because, again, that's another one where you, like, kind of have to sit with a spreadsheet and be like, okay, so this would be the CR, and we'll, you know, we can add in this many modules, and each module will do this. So it gets a little bit fiddly. So I think it's good to have some pre-built ones, but it's also good to have those rules down there to let you be like, all right, here's the process. I can go bam, 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 bam.
Definitely.
It's probably one of my... favorite part. The computer section is probably one of my favorite parts of the book that people don't really talk about at all, because I feel like it's not as flashy as you know, the new classes or the races.
It's true.
It does seem to be the forgotten subsystem.
I feel like as people start to figure it out more, it'll be more popular. But for right now, I don't think that its importance to a future world has really been dove into that much yet. There's only a handful of Pathfinder Society adventures, and adventure paths. Like, I'm give it time. Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things, once people stop using them as just traps, I think it's going to open up. There's an option in the book for a contingency style spell onto computers that are breached, so you can add more fun effects in instead of like, hey, you just get electrocuted again. Hey, you just get electrocuted again. It makes it seem more living.
Yeah. Polymorph, you can't touch the keys anymore.
That's right, you're too small. One of the things I also wanted to do was add in some more modules that felt like, you know, things that you use computers to do, like look up information or like do a task that's too tedious or too difficult for you to do as a person. So I enjoyed making up some of those modules too.
You mean you could make a computer module that theoretically would automatically register your Gen Con hotels in half a second?
Maybe. I don't know if I've been a module.
It depends. If there's 75,000 other people who also have that module and they all just kind of like Mr. Burns into the door of the Gen Con website. It seems like all of your computer processes have hit this one door at the same time and are stuck. The slightest breeze could knock them all into the Gen Con website, but there's no breeze on the internet.
I have a question for the both of you. Because I don't know who wrote these. There are two feats involved messing with grenades and opponents. Who wrote those?
That sounds like me.
Armor cutter, where you cut through an attack cuts through the...
That one's definitely Alex.
That is something that I've had players ask me to do a lot, and it's something that currently Starfinder doesn't support, and it supports my internal canon of Starship Troopers, where you just shoot a bug and you throw a grenade down its goop tubes.
Yeah. Well, it's like the idea was actually from Star Wars Episode 5, where like they're fighting the walkers, and I think it's Luke goes in, he cuts a hole, and then somebody throws a grenade, and they just fly away, and they boom! Like that felt so iconic to me. I was like, yeah, this has got to be in. I think messing with grenades is fun.
There's like, another one that's sleight of hand that reminds me of Fallout, where you just like put mines in people's pockets.
I think that one might have been you, Matt. I don't remember. That might have been me too, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's hard for the feats chapter because, you know, you read through the whole thing so many times that it like starts to blur together. So, like,
I know that pretty much all of the feats that involve races I wrote, and pretty much all of the feats that involve classes Matt wrote. He even wrote feats for mine, because what happened was we split the word count for that section in half, and we're like, let's just do stuff. And I was like, all right, let's make some cool feats so these races can use their powers more. Let's make some cool feats like that. Oh, I gotta rewrite Magical Tale, because that feat was awful in Pathfinder.
The interesting thing about Starfinder is too, since all of the feats that give you a bonus are gone, like the feats are just to Alex, basically, like when I sat down to write it, Alex was like, Matt, just write feats that do stuff. Like, so for Starfinder, like the feats really have to give you another ability or do something that, you know, is interesting. There's not a lot of like, oh, you get +2 to that. So it makes it fun to write the feats for it and like pushes you in a creative direction. Oh yeah. Also harder. Definitely.
it's fun, but hard.
I do have another question, and I don't know if it's something I missed. There's a lot of feats that start with the word resolute. Is that a like certain term that I was missing, or is that just coincidence?
It's kind of a play on resolve, because all of those feats let you use racial abilities by spending resolve points if you've already used it for the day.
Okay.
And sometimes I think a couple class features have resolute feats. It was just kind of like, at least for me, I like the code words where, like, if you see a feat with extra in its name, you kind of know what that's going to do. If you see a feat with extended, you kind of know what that's going to do. Yeah, you kind of get a gist. And I think having, like, recurring language that gives you this clue about what the feat is going to entail is helpful to new players. And a lot of what we designed this book to do was be a book that felt accessible to people who were just starting Starfinder, because the book came out on day one. It needed to be accessible to everybody.
Now, the other feat I had a question about was, whose idea was it for the storied backstory and improved storied backstory, and why weren't they just called fanfic?
That was definitely Alex.
I mean, that's just called the Christopher Lee story, where you're a soldier, then you're an actor, then you're a metal singer. Like, you ascend your original bounty.
So this is going to sound really dumb, but like that feat happened because James and I were watching, we were watching Guilty Crown when I wrote that, I think. And so like in, in Guilty Crown, the main character basically starts out as just having, like, the themeless. So, like, he's a nobody. And then out of nowhere, like, his life changes and he gets, like, he's a soldier person, but, like, he's also still kind of a nobody. Like, he's got both. And I feel like that's a common trope in stories in general. But the problem is that by itself, a theme is way more powerful than one feat. Usually how it's balanced is, like, the first two or three theme benefits are about as strong as a feat, and then the last couple ones are about as strong as a feat, which is why it's split up. But yeah, I think, and I've actually seen it pop up on the forums a couple times since, where people have been like, oh, well, you know, my character can change and grow during the story arc, but their theme can never change. Like, this was kind of the idea of, like, okay, well, you know, you can have more as you go along. Like, you can grow in new ways if it's something you want to spend your talent and time on.
Yeah, you're not always that hoodlum on a West Philly basketball court, you know. Sometimes you live it up in Bel Air.
I mean, so, you know, you don't always start. You don't always stay being a meatball head forever. Sometimes you become the queen of the moon.
No idea.
Oh, I just made a really bad Sailor Moon joke. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. So that was the idea behind that one. Did you have any other feat questions, Param or James?
No, those are my big ones. Just about the, because I saw that the Resolute was there, and a lot of them were class features, and one of them I just thought was a or race features, and one of them was a class feature, and I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Now I get what it means.
Okay. So Seth Lavox asks, considering the Starfarer Companion Ranger's lack of casting an optional animal companion and studied target instead of favorite enemy, did you guys consider calling it the Slayer instead? Also, was the Iconic supposed to look like Han Solo? So for that last part, I asked Owen, and since he did the Iconic art order, he said yes, it was. So it was totally designed to look like Han Solo. I joke with Owen that his name is Han Soon, but he doesn't have a canonical name. And in terms of it being called the Slayer, I never really considered calling it the Slayer, but it's very, like, you know, Slayer is kind of a hybrid class off of Ranger, and I think that one of the things the Slayer does really well, especially as someone who's played a Slayer in Carrion Crown, and I later took that one feat that, like, lets you double your bonus against one type of enemy, like, to me, like, that feels like the perfect Ranger mechanic, because you still have stuff you can do to enemies when you're not fighting the one thing you're good at, but man, when you fight that guy you're good at, you pound him into the dirt, and, like, at least I felt like that was a mechanic. And then so, like, the idea became that with the Ranger the methodologies came out, where you had Rangers who got different powers based on, like, different aspects of their being. It's like, well, yeah, obviously the Slayer is a methodology. You have the Fey Warden version, which is, like, you're a Ranger who has all the Druid powers because you have this kind of nature connection. And then there was one that was also based off of the 3.5 Scout archetype, which is all these Skirmisher abilities. Basically, it was like, how does a Ranger fit in the future? And how can I build options that let you pick which version of the Ranger you want to be? Because one thing that Starfinder doesn't have is a strong wilderness class, but at the same time, I didn't feel that an entire class should just be about wilderness, lest it suffer from, like, Cavalier. Oh, I'm going in Shattered Star Dungeon, so I can't have a mount. Don't play a Cavalier. Like, make sure there are options that the class is flexible.
That's a sad Cavalier.
That is a very sad Cavalier.
Also, Matt Benanche wants to give a huge shout out to Jacob Blackman. And yes, we compliment Jacob's artwork a lot on this podcast. It's a long-standing tradition on this podcast network to compliment Jacob's artwork. And this really was his time to shine. I think that the Starfinder art style works really good with Jacob's comic booky influences and styles with his art, and I loved a lot of the pieces he's done with this book. So we like to compliment the artist when we know him, especially when it looks like it was good. So good job, Jacob.
Yeah, like I've said to Jacob, Jacob does fine fantasy art, but, like, just his tendency of doing, like, really action, dynamic, superhero-looking pieces with, like, bright colors, like, that really fit our Starfinder style, which is, like I mentioned, like, retro 80s in space. And I think that his work really shines with our Starfinder stuff between Owen and myself.
I loved his Gripply, especially, and
yeah,
the energy armor that the Magus is wearing fits really well, too.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that one. She's actually a Sully, canonically. We didn't have a we wanted to make sure that all of the iconics in the book were races from the book. So she's a Sully. The paladin, I think, is an Asmar, but it's a really robot looking Asmar. In my head, she's like an android with like holy powers. But I mean, and Asmars can be whatever. Yeah, no, she's supposed to be like an Asmar. And then you have gosh, what was the other one? Matt, do you remember it was a Dampier Wizard. I remember that.
Dampier Wizard.
And then it was the Sylph Bard, the Ranger Kitsune. And did I miss one? Cleric. Who was the cleric? Oh, he was a Samsaran, right? Yeah, all right. So yeah. So that's right. Question. I remember. I think he was a Samsaran. I remember that. I totally remember my book.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, James, flashing your note about the android paladin. It's supposed to be an Asmar, but in your game, it could be whatever you want.
Yeah.
Okay, gang, we are coming up on time. So, what is it? Is there any current projects? Let's start with Matt. Where can people find you if they want to follow your work right now?
Sure. I keep pretty up to date on my Paizo profile with the list of my works, and I keep that pretty up to date as people come out. My username on the Paizo boards is Chester Copperpot. So you can look for that or follow any of the comments on the product thread for this product. I have an alias that's M. Morris on there, which is the curse of having a very common name. You can see my work in Alex's Everyman Minis line for Pathfinder. For more of my Starfinder work, I've been doing a product line called the Starfinder's Codex for Owen for Rogue Genius Games. And so far, there's a Witch Legacy class conversion out for that, and also a book of equipment that you might use if you were going to explore a planet, the Essential Explorer's Handbook. So, and there's going to be a few more of those coming out fairly soon.
His witch is super cool. They get sniper weapon proficiency.
They do.
Hexy from a mile away, jeez.
Yeah, you hex bullets. Boom! It's like the most anime thing ever. I love it. It's such a cool class.
I see that the anime contingent is going to continue to rise on this podcast. This is not a
bad thing. What is more anime than an android Asimar, an heavenly robot?
Yeah. The BYO anime subtext. Since I only have like a passing familiarity, so I'm glad that it scratches that itch for people too.
Thanks to James, I have enough anime for both of us.
You're doing God's work, James.
Thank you.
Well, no, we even had a conversation the other night where James is like, the real reason I keep exposing you to all this anime is so that I give you cool anime ideas for class features that are awesome. Instead of like boring fantasy ones.
I said one of the features, it was not all corruption. It was only partially corruption.
No, listen, if you don't get to use your position and your lot in life to corrupt other people to get things that you want, then you're not playing the game right.
Did you meet a small devil about this tall? Did he shrink you into an arena and change how you think? I think so.
No, I just have higher standards for my anime characters.
I think Matt Banach had a good idea for a wrap-up.
Do it. Do it. I like this one. It's he wants the four of us to answer number one, what is your favorite new thing in the book? And number two, what is your favorite old/converted thing? Parham, go.
Good. All right, good. I don't know. My favorite old/converted thing is definitely. Well,
start with new if you don't know.
Your favorite new and then your favorite converted.
Good grief. My favorite new was the Hollow module for the computers because it was so obvious that it needed to exist. And it opens up a lot of possibilities with using the computer system. And my favorite old converted thing was the Magus.
Cool. Nice.
Thanks.
Changing Spellstrike really made that class a little more bearable. My favorite new thing would probably be the evolutions on the companions because... what use is a companion if it's just the same as the others? It's kind of why I like Eidolons. The companions are old, but the system form is new. As far as converted old things, the Ranger. I was actually surprised looking over a lot of its features, how much I dug what it did. It kind of felt like the operative that I was thinking of making, it would really be a ranger.
Yeah. All right, Matt, you can go.
Let's see. My favorite new thing is probably the computer system. Like in general, just the idea of treating them more like a hazard or a trap that can give you some XP. I was really excited to design that. My favorite old thing is sort of like a quasi-old thing, and it's the Wizard Traditions, which is like an update of favored, of Wizard School, Arcane School, that I had a lot of fun writing, and let me put in some of the stuff from Pathfinder Wizard archetypes that you might want to play in Starfinder. So that was probably my favorite converted thing that I did.
My favorite new thing is the planetoid class ships. I like that we have this just ridiculously big ship classification. It let us. I know that you don't like that the math doesn't work out, James. James, do you want to go ahead and tell them what you mean with the math?
I mean, it's an absolute system of either size or weight, and neither fits the classification of either. Like, I get planetoid on a scale of a galactic scale is like a mile or less, but with the that's not really a planetoid. A planetoid spaceship is the moon in Gurren Lagann. I don't know. It's me. I'm a huge baby. Just ignore me.
Well, I think our idea was that planetoid would be have a minimum of that mile, then could be any size bigger.
Right. It's all minimums, but it's like it's just how the Starfinder scale started.
Yeah. It's okay. We all know that James is the guy who calculates the exact density of air to figure out the ships are right or wrong.
I was telling these guys I didn't get around to reading 20 spells because I got upset about the tonnage on the ship classification here, and then I wanted to see the densities of things like iron just to see how big it would have to be, and it took a lot of time. It was dumb.
This is why all of you people on Discord, if you have random questions, just type them out and tag James, and there's like a 67% chance James might either know them or know where to find the answers, or might just make fun of you for asking them.
If you would like, go to CodeSwitch, and you can see a bunch of math-based articles about, I don't know, how the batteries in Starfinder are more impressive than any other thing in the game.
that is James in a nutshell. So my favorite thing that was converted, I hate to say this one, but honestly, it was the magical tail feat chain. I never thought that was very satisfying in Pathfinder, even as a guy who has an oracle with the different curses and stuff. I feel like in the Starfinder's Handbook, the tails are balanced, but they very feel much like something you are happy to get whenever you get them. Mostly because the list of powers is really impressive. And it also feeds off of mythology a lot better than the Pathfinder version.
All right. So if you want more No Direction content, make sure you go to the No Direction... Oh, James?
Didn't you have a shout-out, Matt, for a certain location?
Oh, I was going to say just shout-out to Red Cap's Corners in Philadelphia for being the place where I started playing role-playing games. And just has a great community there. And really got me started on playing and on writing. So, shout out to Red Cap's Corners.
We're probably going to have our aid another convention sometime in the next century.
Or Sealy.
Yeah.
Is it aid another first?
Maybe. We'll see how that gets scheduled.
That's true. I hope so.
Anyway, lots of awesome conventions and stuff there. You guys should check it out if you are at all local to Philadelphia. Yeah.
I don't know if you guys realize this, but like Parham is outnumbered 3-1 on Philly guys right now. So
we the best.
Sorry, Parham.
All right. Oh yeah, James, you just mentioned something we need to shout out to. The much anticipated updates to the Starship DCs is out. It's on the Starfinder FAQ section. I imagine this will appear in a third printing of the Starfinder books. The second printing already exists, but it's just to fix the spine issue. So get your updated charts ready, because you really want to get this math right, because it don't work unless you get this math from them.
Yeah, in general,
was this when we fought Keely?
Yeah, that would have made it so I could have moved backwards. In general, it decreased the DCs on a lot of checks, including piloting, so you don't need to have somebody in every crew who's an exact ace pilot, and it allows other people to participate a little bit more.
Yeah, without this update, there were literally some maneuvers that were impossible at high tiers for even somebody that dedicated every possible option to piloting.
20 plus one half starship tier plus yada.
Yep. All right. If you want to catch up more of the No Direction content, you can find us at nodirectionpodcast.com. We're also on facebook.com/nodirection. And we also have a Twitter that you can get to from the website. You can catch us on YouTube at youtube.com/nodirectionshow. We had to add the show there. And of course, we're always live, and you can see our archives at twitch.tv/nodirection. If you've got comments, you can send them in to nodirection@hotmail.com for any questions you have that you want to get to us the slow mail way, as opposed to watching live. And we also have a Discord. The Discord is great and always growing, and it is hopping. So if you want to talk with us throughout the weeks, just sort of, you know, pal around with a lot of No Direction fans, you can go on our Discord, and it's pretty much going nonstop all the time, 24/7.
It's a party up in here.
We do
party liches in the Discord tonight.
Yeah, we would appreciate it if you like the show to go give us a review on iTunes. That helps the show out a lot. Remember to like, follow, subscribe, depending on which service you're viewing us on. That helps us out a lot. And we appreciate every single comment that you all give us. So,
everyone. Each and everyone.
So, until next time, go beyond.